chapter 18. And we're starting at text number 24. We are now going to go into the varshas that are north of Hilavritta, Ramyaka, Hiranmaya, and Kuru, or Uttara Kuru.
Do you know what the position or the rotation of the sun is in relationship to each gun would be?
Yeah, the sun is a number of yojan is out.
Okay.
You know, on the just above there's the plane that Jambudvip is on,
okay,
and which all the ring islands are on. It's called Bhumandala. There's the Manasottara mountain, which is in the middle of one of the dvipas, and the sun runs along the top of that mountain.
So then all these areas experience the same days that we do, time period
wise? Yes, so far as I know.
Okay. Yeah. But their lifespan is longer?
Well, it says the lifespan here, as it's already said, is 1,000 years. Okay, so Ramyaka, Hiranmaya, Ramyaka, we just say Ramyaka. Ramyaka, Ramya means attractive. Ramyaka is one of the names of the sons of Anitra, over whom this varsha is named. So these three northern varshas, I mentioned this before, all three forms of the Lord have to do with aquatic adventures. First, in Ramyaka Varsha, is Matsya Avatar. In the next Varsha in the north is Kurma Avatar. And then Varaha. So the two are aquatics, and the third was accused of being an aquatic or an amphibious beast. We have those there. I don't know if there's any significance to that, but that's what it is. Huh? Well, here's the text up here. Let me make it available. Right. Move this a little closer. There we go. Oh, wow, what happened? Touch the wrong button. I'm getting tired of computers, I'll tell you. Yeah. So in Ramyaka, it says, where Vaivasvata Manu rules, the Supreme Personality of Godhead appeared as Lord Matsya at the end of the last era, in a Chakshusha Manvatara. Vaivasvata Manu now worships Lord Matsya in pure devotional service and chants the following mantra. At the end of the last era, if we go to 2.7.12, with a short description of Matsya Avatar, of course there's whole chapters later on in the Bhagavatam describing this Matsya Avatar, but here, at the end of the millennium, Prabhupada uses the word millennium. Here it says Yuga Ante. Sometimes a Kalpa he calls a millennium. But anyway, at the end of the millennium, the would-be Vaivasvata Manu, in other words, in the next Manu Manvantara period, he's Vaivasvata Manu. So in Chakshusha, the previous one, Vaivasvata means son of Vivishwan. And his personal name, we already ran across it, it's Shradadev. It's his personal name. But then, in the previous thing, he was known as Satyavrata. And so he would see the Lord in the fish incarnation, that the Lord in the fish incarnation, the shelter of all kinds of living entities, up to those in the earthly planets. And that's because, well, because my fear of the vast waters at the end of the millennium, the Vedas come out of my, Brahma speaking this, my mouth, and the Lord enjoys those vast waters and protects the Vedas. What's happening here is that in one day of Brahma, there are 14 reigns of Manu. The reign of a Manu is called a Manvantara, the period of one mana, Manu. So there are 14 Manus. And each Manu, each Manvantara spans 71 Divya Yugas. Here I'm trying to be precise, a Divya Yuga is a cycle of four Yugas. That's called a Divya Yuga, right? So there are 71 Yuga cycles. Each Manvantara is 306,720,000 human years. This is a long period of time. 71 Divya Yugas. Now, if they're 14 and 71 and you multiply them together, you find that there are 994 Divya Yugas in one day of Brahma. Now, we say Brahma lasts 1,000 Yuga cycles. So what gives? What gives is that actually Brahma's day really does contain 994 Yuga cycles. The missing time, which is equal to the duration of six Divya Yugas, is taken up by asandhya. You know the word sandhya? It means a transition period. Tri-sandhya, dawn, noon, and dusk. The transition from night to day, from morning to afternoon, and from day to night. So this is also, there's a sandhya, and so within the duration of each yuga, there's a sandhya at the beginning and the end, equal to a few hundred years of the gods. So there are sandhyas in connection with the manvantaras. Before each manvantara and one following the last, that adds up to 15 sandhyas. And the length of the sandhya is the length of a satya yuga, which is 1/4 of a divya yuga. I mean, 4/10 of a divya yuga. That's a satya yuga. The way you can think of the yuga cycles is that satya yuga is 40% or 4/10, treta yuga is 30%, dwapara yuga is 20%, and kali yuga is 10%. So they add up to 100%. That's the durations. So that's what happens.
You said satya then dwapara or satya then treta?
Treta.
Treta.
Yeah. Right. Satya, treta, dwapara.
Because there's a shift only in this.
I think so, yeah, it's only
this. Only this one,
yeah,
satya, treta, then dwapara.
Yeah. The usual list is satya, or also called krita sometimes, satya yuga, krita yuga, treta, dwarpa, and kali. That's the percentages, 40, 30, 20, and 10. And it's easy if you count in years of the devas. Because the total yuga cycle is 12,000 years of the gods. And so Kali Yuga is 1,200, and Dwapara Yuga is twice that, so it's just 3,600, such as 4,800. Then you have to multiply by 360 to get human. the human years, and you got these weird numbers, 4,320,000, so.
There's this shift of yugas. Percentage stays the same, in the sense that Dvapara goes is 20%, or when you change, Dvapara becomes 30%?
I don't know. I don't know how that works. Okay. That's the only one place Prabhupada says it. And and I tried to check it out once, I couldn't find anything about it. Anyway, these manvantaras, it's kind of a big change, because when a manu changes, there's a whole new set of devatas headed by Indra. One it's like when there's a political change, you know, one government leaves and a whole new government comes in. And so sometimes we somebody is prompt, you know, next manvantara you could be the Indra, get promoted up there. So there's also the seven sages change, the saptarshis is a whole new bunch of those. And also this is the point, at each manvantara at the end, or some places Prabhupada says not everyone, but generally there's an inundation up to Bhumandala. That's why it says in this verse, the fish incarnation, the shelter of all kinds of living entities, up to those in the earthly planets. So that the water goes that high. Then of course, at Brahma's night, it goes all the way up to Dhruvaloka, Mahaloka, Tapaloka, Jnanaloka, and Satchaloka are not affected. That's water. And then at the end of Brahma's life, it's not water anymore, it's fire. And that gradually rises all the way to the top of the universe. So every time you turn around, there's a devastation of one kind. It's just like devastation after devastation. So So here, Vaivasvatamanu is now one of the places he describes here as ruling. In the present, he's our present Manu. Is now worshipping this deity of Matsya Avatar because they had formed a pretty tight relationship. You remember the narration how he found this the little fish and he captured them, and put them in bigger and bigger containers, and so on. So then, this is the Upanishadic mantra. We'll chant this one. Let's break this word. Pranaya, and then Ojase. We'll break that word up, right? Where the sandhi goes. Right here, right there. Pranaya, Ojase. Ready? Let's chant this one. Om Namo Bhagavate Mukhyatamaya Namaha.
Om Namo Bhagavate Mukhyatamaya Namaha.
Sattvaya Pranaya.
Sattvaya Pranaya.
Ojase Sahase Balaya.
Ojase Sahase Balaya.
Mahatmatsyaya Namaha.
Mahatmatsyaya Namaha.
You see, he calls him Mahamatsya, big fish, very big fish. And notice he's Mukhyatama, the first incarnation to appear, Mukhyatama, the very first, you'd say. And I think in the purport, Prabhupada points this out. I offer my respectful obeisances to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is pure transcendence. He is the origin of all life, bodily strength, mental power, and sensory ability. That same list is there. Ojase, Sahase, Balaya, and so on. Known as Matsya Avatar, the gigantic fish incarnation, he appears first among all the incarnations. Again, I offer my obeisances unto him. And Prabhupada begins by quoting from the song of Jayadeva Goswami. Pralaya payodi jale dutavan asidedam vihitavahita charitam makedam kejavadukta amina sarira jayadavadishanari. Here's the translation of that one. O Keshava, O Lord of the universe, O Hari, who have assumed the form of a fish, all glories to you, you easily acted as a boat in the form of a giant fish. Well, our account has him pulling a boat. You wondered how Noah's Ark got around? Just to give protection to the Vedas, which had become immersed in the turbulent sea of devastation. That's what Jayadeva's song says.
Somewhere I think
the size of what Matsya is mentioned. I don't know
where.
I remember reading it. Where?
In
Sadhguru's
book, one of the books.
Uh-huh.
He mentioned that he grew, I can't remember what it is, 8 million miles?
Yeah, the size is gigantic. That's true. You can look it up, yeah.
But I think, does he get that from the Bhagavatam?
Yeah, it's in there. There's a measurement in there.
It's either 8 billion or 8 million or something.
I told you, Kurma is as big as Jambudvip. He's 100,000 yojanas in diameter. But he's big. And remember, he has a horn, and then the fastened to the horn is the ark. Which, by the way, has all kinds of seeds on it. They left that out of the Bible account of the flood. Because certainly everything that was in the water must have died. You know, because you have a big flood, it kills all the seeds. They didn't think about that. It's just the animals and pears got aboard, but not the herbs. Yeah, he has a horn. He has a fish with a horn, like a narwhal has a horn. So again, here Prabhupada wants to simply make the point that although they take the form of fish and so on, they're still transcendental. Why not? That's my question. People object, why not? If God wants to show up as a fish, can you say it's not allowed? Who sets the rules? Because it says that he played in the waters of devastation. I mean, he has a good time. He knows how many human beings would like to be fish. They put on flippers and fins and go down, right? They play in the waters. So it's a natural tendency to want to play in the waters. But if you want to really play in the waters, you should have a fish body. So the Lord does it. Whereas these other people will take birth as fishes. I remember once I was giving a lecture and I told the story about Prabhupada. The first time he saw people surfing in the water. What's that? And probably the surfers should have problem. Probably the sufferers. He said. His estimation of material enjoyment, I suppose. Anyway, so some girls raised her hand afterwards and says, I think surfing is spiritual.
Oh my God.
And I said, why? She says, because you become one with the water. And I said, so do the fish. And she had no reply for that. And you're in danger of taking birth in that form. I remember seeing in the in Miami Temple, you could look out the windows when they had the temple on Miami Beach. You could look out the window and see the dolphins surfing. They would ride the waves in sometimes. Now here's several things. The theme of this one, these verses here, tend to be about how the Lord is in control of everything. That's what's being emphasized in this one. He is anta and bahi. He's inside and outside. But adrista rupa, not seen. He has an unseen form inside and outside. And there's a concern with akila loka palaka, the leaders of the different, well, the loka pala, although the four demigods in charge of the directions, but it's used in a, you know, sort of a general sense. The leaders of the different planets, society, kings, and so on. So they can't see you. And although these people think they're big controllers, akita loka pala, actually they're being controlled by here. And here the Lord is compared to a puppeteer playing with puppets made of wood. Darumai. So becomes under the Lord's control. All living entities. So that's then the next verse. This interesting statement. The Supreme Personality Godhead is antarbahi, present within and without everything. One must overcome the delusion caused by the Lord's external energy and realize His presence both in externally and internally. So, Prabhupada's people say that the Supreme Lord is situated within everyone's heart, is outside. And people say, I can't see God, please show them to me. People are demanding that. So Prabhupada's point is that one has to recognize a subordinate relationship and under the control of the Lord, and then then you can see Him. So then the next verse, a repetition, Lokapala, again. You know, again the Lokapalas. This is the concern of this verse. The great leaders of the universe beginning from Brahma, and they are really Matsara Jvara, burning with the fever of envy. So the way Prabhupada translates this, are all envious of your authority. So everything, you're really the maintainer of everything here, and they couldn't even do their thing without your help. So they don't recognize this. Just to show you something, this is interesting, because it's beginning from Lord Brahma. Is he envious of the Lord, of these great things? Well, here's a couple of places I wanted to mark. Here's is from a couple of purports of Prabhupada. Let me see if I can make it a little bigger. You gotta grab it. There we go. Okay. One purport. He describes what a sinful activity is. Sinful activities are those activities performed in forgetfulness of our relationship with the Lord. In this material world, activities for material enjoyment which are considered to be pious are also sinful. For example, one sometimes gives something in charity to a needy person with a view to getting back the money four times increased. Giving with the purpose of gaining something is called charity in the mode of passion. Everything done here is done in the modes of material nature, and therefore all activities but service to the Lord are sinful. So even piety is sinful. And then in another place is the purport to Bhagavatam. Oh, I got the, I think it's 2.5.10. Here's another one. To be, this is from the third canto, fifth chapter. To be obedient to the wishes of the Supreme Lord is the natural position of every living entity. But due only to past misdeeds, a living being becomes averse to the sense of subordination to the Lord and suffers all the miseries of material existence. This is where averse to the sense of subordination to the Lord. No one has anything to do but render devotional service to the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. Therefore, any activity other than transcendental loving service to the Lord is more or less a rebellious action against the Supreme Will. All fruitive activity, empirical philosophy, and mysticism are more or less against the sense of subordination to the Lord, and any living entity engaged in such rebellious activity is more or less condemned by the laws of nature which work under the subordination of the Lord. So the more or less means demigods less, others more, but everyone who's in any sense or other engaged in fruitive activity of any kind, or jnana or yoga, according to this, is to some extent envious. Well, this is a couple of places where Prabhupada says that very clearly, and that the distinction we make between sin and piety on the karmakanda level, ultimately it's all sin. You know, Prabhupada gave that example of the wet stool and the dry stool. Okay, one's better than the other, but ultimately it's all stool. So here, this is the same, the lokapala kila matsara jvara, the fever of envy. So then, Prabhupada talks about people becoming proud of this. And he goes into the, you know, this Dharija Narayan stuff that was started by the Ramakrishna Mission, that instead of serving the, giving food to the deity in the temple, you should give it to the poor person who's also an incarnation of Narayan, and therefore you serve Narayan in the form of a poor man. Then the last one, here he refers now to the pastime. O Almighty Lord, at the end of the millennium, this planet Earth, which is the source of all kinds of herbs, drugs, and trees, was inundated by water and drowned beneath the devastating waves. So I think when it says it goes up to Bhumandala, it means including it. Bhumandala goes underwater, like Mayapur. Not really deeply underwater, but... At that time, you protected me along with the Earth and roam the sea with great speed. Okay, so this is the prayer that's offered. He leads the Manu leads the those verses and the prayers to Matsya Avatar.
In the translation, it just says planet Earth. Is that referring to?
Well, let's see what it says here. He uses the word Shonin, which is another word for Earth. Shonin. I think it does. I don't know if we can tell. Let me just check. I forgot. I looked this word up. It just... It's like a word like boo, you know? I mean, what are you going to do? Do that. I have two of these up. What's wrong? How did it go? Shoma. Where is it? Shoni, the earth. That's what it says. See, yeah, it wasn't particularly illuminating. It seems to be related to a word for Shona, which means immovable. Even says BHP, that's the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavat Purana, 4:21:35. So, and then Shoni with the long I, it's usually a form of Shona. Shoni, earth god, a Brahmana, Shoni, the Kamadina, Shoni, mandala, orbit of the earth. Here's a nice one. Shoni Maya, containing or representing the earth, said of Vishnu in his fish incarnation, Bhagavat Prana 2.7.12. There you go, looking. Look at a lot of stuff here. Here's another. Shoni, the earth, Bhagavatam 3.14. They got a lot. So just the earth, whatever, how much of the earth that mean by the earth, it doesn't say. Would you like to read dictionaries for fun? This one, to Vona Williams, you can trip out in forever, you know. Anything else about this one? Then we move right along. Let's see if anything prevalent. Now, here we go to Hiranmaya. In Hiranmaya Varsha, the Lord resides Kurma Tanum. And the Tanu is body, huh? Nanda Tanuja, born of the body of Nanda Tanu. Kurma Tanum. The body of a tortoise manifesting, body of a tortoise. And it's called Priyattamam Tanum, a most lovely or dearmost form. This most dear and beautiful form, he says here, is always worshipped there in devotional service by Aryama, the chief resident of Hiranmaya Varsha, along with other inhabitants of that land. They chant the following hymns. Aryama is mentioned here specifically. You'll notice right here, Pitri Gana Adipati, the Adipati, the chief of the Pitas, which we know from Bhagavad Gita. Pitta not being a tree, but a Pitri. and they chant. Then Prabhupada says the word Priyatama, dearmost, most dear, or most beloved, is very significant in this verse. Every devotee regards a particular form of the Lord as most dear. Because of an atheistic mentality, some people, I hope there are none in this room, think that the tortoise, boar, and fish incarnations of the Lord are not very beautiful. They do not know that any form of the Lord is always the fully opulent personality of Godhead. Since one of his opulences is infinite beauty, all the Lord's incarnations are very beautiful and are appreciated as such by the devotees. So you just have to understand that they, all of them are really lovely.
The first thing we can...
I mean, people collect beautiful fish, you know. I've seen aquariums full of just absolutely gorgeous fish. And I even know some turtle people.
First thing we get in our minds, you know, that these things we know in this world, like the war, it's ugly. Try to get rid of this conception.
Sadaputa, you know, it's clear that everything here comes from there. So in some way, what you see here is a transcendent, you know, is somewhere Prabhupada says that the Lord incarnates in every species of life. He says that a number of times. And people have asked me, you know, we don't know all of them, or at least we don't have any record of all of them. Some we know about, like Hamsavatar is mentioned, but there's nothing about Hamsavatar in the Bhagavatam, his incarnation as a Hamsa, which we always translate as swan. It might be more better understood as a goose. Or when we say topmost swan-like devotee, we always think of these, you know, swans with the long necks. The swan in India is a kind of a duck, but topmost duck-like devotee doesn't make it. For some reason, a goose-like devotee. We say swan because of the connotations of English words. Anyway, they're all of them quite beautiful. Oh, Sadaputa, we were talking once about evolution, and there are. You know, one of the arguments for evolution is that you see, like if you look at the hoof of a horse, the bones, it looks like there are finger bones in there. But what has happened is one nail has become the hoof, or two nails. Like I think one nail has become the hoof, or maybe two nails have become the hoof. It's like a horse is standing on one, and the other finger bones are there, but they're very tiny. They don't do anything. So it looks like you have a hand or a paw or something with a thumb and fingers, but it's been modified like this. And so they use this. Or if you look at the X-ray of a whale flipper, you see finger or digits, you know. But it's a solid thing. And so they say, you know, the whale was a land animal originally. It went back to the sea and so on. Or the horse. Because you see these connections like this. So Sadaputta says, what if, like, you, the human form is the prototype form, And then when you make animals, you just take it and modify it. Like if you were an engineer, and you had the you'd have the genetic code that was a kind of a complete genetic code, and then which is like basically a human or human-like form. And then to make all the animals, some of the animal species, you just modify that. And in fact, the fact is one of the big things for evolution is the fact that that, you know, at least the biblical account is the animals are there and everything, and then, you know, humans are like entirely separate creation, have nothing to do with them. It's just there's no relationship. But we see from the Veda, the account in the Bhagavatam, the Vedas, they're all literally genetic descendants of Brahma. Like Brahma has a complete genetic code, and then because some of the Prajapati's daughters become the, you give birth to the snakes, and some give birth to the birds, and some give birth to, you know, all the different, so they all descend in this way. So naturally they're all have this, you know, that all living beings, you know, they 90% of their genetic makeup is the same and so on. That certainly supports this account here. So similarly, that everything ultimately comes from Krishna. So the potentiality for all these different forms are there in Krishna, and he shows them. And here we say higher lore, but when Krishna does it, they're all Krishna. So. Non-devotees think that Lord Krishna's incarnations are ordinary material creatures, and therefore distinguish between the beautiful and the not beautiful. So a certain form of the Lord is worshipped by a particular devotee because he loves to see that form of the Lord. But that doesn't mean that they think they just have, you know, this one has a particular taste for a particular form of the Lord, but the others are not considered ugly or anything like that. Well, that's a nice purport about how they're all beautiful. We should appreciate them. So here's their. That sounds amplified, doesn't it? Are they going by?
They're on the trolley.
Oh, that's a trolley. Okay. This is an interesting. This is an interesting one. We'll split it up here where it says. Here we have to split it up. Vishanaya, Visheshanaya, Anupalakshita Stanaya, huh? Otherwise I think we can manage. Look at the number of namos in this one. They're namahas, really. There's a lot of them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 namahas in this one. This is the prayer to Kurma. Om Namo Bhagavate Akuparaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Akuparaya.
Sarva Sapta Guna Visheshanaya.
Sarva Sapta Guna Visheshanaya.
Anupalakshita Stanaya Namaho.
Anupalakshita Stanaya Namaho.
Varshmane Namo.
Varshmane Namo.
Umne namo namo vastitanaya namaste.
Umne namo namo vastitanaya namaste.
The word is avastanaya. There's an Ada that's a leaded out, the shelter of all. I don't know quite how to break this up, you know, that the moles go at the end or the beginning. Anyway. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you who have assume the form of a tortoise, Akuparaya. You're the reservoir of all transcendental qualities, and the Sarva Sattva Guna Visheshanaya. This form consists of Shuddha Sattva, transcendental goodness. You are perfectly, you move here and there in the water. He says, this is added, but no one can discern your position. That's the implication. Anupalakshitastanaya, whose position is not discernible. There's a lot with all of these, there's a kind of emphasis on being unseen or unknown or unperceived by materialistic people. Namaha Varshmane, the oldest, unaffected by time, the way that's translated. Bhumne means the greatest, everywhere, the shelter of everyone. Mm-hmm. You are not limited by past or the future, present everywhere, the shelter of all things, and therefore I offer my respectful obeisance unto you again and again. For Prabhupada's point here, therefore, although the Lord is present everywhere, he cannot be seen with ordinary eyes. As Arya Maha says, the Lord is anupakshitastana. No one can locate him. This is the greatness of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then the metrical prayers. Again, Avyapadesha Rupine, whose real form is Avyapadesha, cannot be calculated. Well, this is cool, let me show you this. Avyapadesha, and we go to the dictionary and put it in. Oops, why did it do that? I must have forgot to save it. Yeah, this is nice. Make this down a little bit. See right here? Avyapadesha, no designation or pointing to. Avyapadesha Rupin, whose shape admits of no name or appellation. Bhagavad Purana. There we are. Huh? So this is applied to Kurma here. Not to be defined. Can't be pointed to or anything like that.
Undefinable.
Huh?
Undefinable.
Undefinable, right. No name, no appellation. Huh?
Like the impersonal says,
in a verse that says, of whom the rupa, nijamayaya arpitam, manifest by his personal form. And what it's saying here is that the bahu rupa rupitam, that is to say the universal form, is not your real form. And then Prabhupada, as he does it, except for a devotee in transcendental consciousness, no one can perceive your actual form. So what the impersonalists say is not entirely false, it's just limited. When you have Rupa Goswami quoting, Atasi Krishna Namadi Nabhaved Grayam Indriyai, that's the impersonalist point. But it says Krishna's, it doesn't say he has no name, form, qualities, and pastimes, but they cannot be grasped by our senses, including the mind. So therefore, when you look into transcendence with materially contaminated mind and senses, you will draw a blank. What you see is an effect, a sign that says you can go north no further, off limits. You look into transcendence, materialize, you draw a blank. Then you think transcendence is a blank, but you're just reporting on your own blindness. And of course that verse goes on, Sevan Mukehi Jiva Do Swaya Mevis Purachadaha. However, when those same senses are engaged in Krishna service, Swaya Mevis Purachadaha, then they become enabled, or re-enabled, we should say, because that's their original purpose. Right? So in all these verses there's these statements that sound like impersonal, but if you see them in the context, a lot of Prabhupada's, be careful not to get anybody confused, you know, but a lot of times you see, if you look at the Sanskrit in the Bhagavatam, it says the quality of one who has no qualities, the form of one who has no form, and so on. Well, that means spiritual qualities and spiritual form. So the negative is sort of part of the way there, but it's just not the last word. It's the next to the last word. Negation of the material is not the positive spiritual. So therefore, since the Mayavada philosophers think the universal form to be real is personal form illusory. And he gives his example. Fire has heat and light, which are three energies of the fire and the fire itself. Anyone can understand that the original fire is the reality, and heat and light, the fire's energy. Heat and light are the formless energies of fire, and in that sense they are unreal. Only the fire has form, and therefore it is the real form of heat and light. This is an example to try to explain this. Then Prabhupada gives it, something he explains over and over again. The entire material creation is resting on Krishna's energy, either material, spiritual, or marginal. But because his form is absent from the expansion of his energy, he's not personally present. This inconceivable expansion of the Supreme Lord's energy is called Achintya Shakti. Therefore, no one can understand the real form of the Lord without becoming his devotee. That which is achintya can be known by devotees. It doesn't mean it's unknowable. It's just that the way you go about it is not the way you go about knowing everything in the material world. And so now there's an inventory of the Lord's energies. And here, although they are different in various names, see, list all, you manifest your different energies in countless forms. And then all kinds of different living entities, how they're born, the moving, the standing, the demigods, the sages, the pittas, outer space, the higher planetary systems, the earth with all its features, all the stars and planets are simply manifestations of your different energies, but originally you are one without a second. So there's a list, and then it ends, iti. Thus, see, this, all these things, this is simply a list, every word, charachara, the moving, the unmoving, deva, rishi, pitti, bhutan, Aindriyam, the gods, Jyao, Kam, Shitti, Shaila, Sarit, Samudra, Dvipas, the Grahas, and then Itti, Abideya, Ekaha. Thus they are all named and they are one. The Sanskrit's really, really simple, huh? So how Prabhupada, they are your manifestations of your different energies, but originally you are one without a second. He's Eka. Everywhere it insists on this, right? Ekam Eva Aditya Brahman. Upanishads say Brahman is that besides which there is no second thing. So that's why it is important to understand that Krishna includes his energies. Krishna and Krishna's energies constitute the absolute truth. He includes them, but he also transcends them. That's why Prabhupada insists there's nothing beyond you. See how Prabhupada just kind of blows us up a little bit. There's nothing, expands it. There's nothing beyond you, Eka. That's all that there is you. This entire cosmic manifestation is therefore not false. See, the Mayavadis want to say there's only one without a second by saying the energies do not exist. Mayavad philosophy says the Lord has no energies. You meet a lot of people that think they know what Mayavad philosophy is. In fact, you meet a lot of Mayavadis who don't know that's what their philosophy is, because it's the big cover-up. Because it's so stark. When it said Jagat Mitya, they really mean that Jess is not there. In other words, it's an illusory superimposition. Brahman is a homogeneous one thing, and there's no second thing.
Illusion is not an illusion?
And the illusion, well, Jiva Goswami says, then whose illusion is it? Well, it can't be the Jivas, because the Jivas are the product of the illusion. It can't be Brahman, because an illusion is more powerful than Brahman, and whose illusion is it? Therefore, the Mayavadis say about Maya is this anuvachaniya. It cannot be spoken of either as existing or as not existing, which is a cute way out of the problem. In other words, when you have it, you have it. Then when you don't have it, you don't want it, you don't have it.
Do you
know what somebody asks? Whose illusion is it? Yeah, whose illusion is it? Because it's just this free-floating illusion that's not doesn't belong to anybody, and is just... Ramanujacharya is really funny in this book of his criticizing the Mayavadis. They say this is unreal, they say that is unreal, they say speech is unreal, they say mind is unreal, they say the world is unreal, and so on. He has a whole inventory. And then all these things they know from Shastra, which are also unreal. The verse in Sanskrit is quite far out. This whole list of beings, starting with all the different kinds of borns, and then the people that are born, and then all the different classes of beings, and then all the elements, and then all the things of the earth, and then they're named, and then Ekaha. This verse completely rejects the theory of Brahma Satyam Jagat Mitya. That's a Mayavadi slogan. Brahman is Satyam, is true or real, and the Jagat is Mitya, false. And the Prabhupada says, nothing is false. One thing may be permanent and another temporary, but both the permanent and the temporary are facts. You know, he just, nothing is. In other words, the energy of the Supreme Lord is as permanent as the Lord himself, although his energy is sometimes manifest and sometimes not. As summarized in the Vedas, Sarvam Kalpitam Brahma. Everything is in fact Brahma. So we accept those statements like that. But that's why our position is called Savishesha. That there's this one Brahman, but it has differentiations. Vishesha. Vishesha is a term that means particulars, or Prabhupada always translates variety. Or differentiation is variegatedness, differentiation. Whereas the Mayavada position is called Nirvishesha. And Prabhupada is going to play the Nirvishesha Shunyavada Paschanti Deshtana. Particularly put that's in his Prana mantra, which is written by Prabhupada, because nobody else knew his Sanskrit. Preaching in the Western countries. Funny, he says the West, Nirvishesha Shunyavada, because both of these began in India, but where the condition is everywhere. Then the last verse, because it ends in the Ekti. So here you see, in you, Yasmin, in the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in Asankhya Vishesha, here the word Vishesha is there, huh? Nama, Rupa, Akrita, the Kavis, they say, your name, form, and bodily features are expanded into countless forms. No one can determine exactly how many forms exist. Yet you yourself, in your incarnation as the learned scholar Kapila Dev. Now what it says in the Sanskrit is Sankhya Nirdarshana. The one who is the revealer of this, probably this numerical knowledge. Sankhya means to count, really, but also to categorize or classify. By which one can enumerate the different truths. If you're interested in Sankhya philosophy, in this numbering or classification, we must hear from you. Unfortunately, non-devotees, he says, simply count the different elements and remain ignorant of your actual form.
Is
there?
The prayer is actually text number 35, and the third Guru verse begins with 34. It's like,
oh, I made a mistake, huh? Mm-hmm. I have it here.
Yes,
it ends in 33. What is it?
Yeah, there's three lines, and then the three go together.
Yeah. So it's prayers for three shlokas. 31, 32, and 33.
So this is 33, and the next one starts at 34?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Fixes three. So then becomes 34. I have to move the other numbers up or what?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, that's true. Sometimes we do these things late at night and in a hurry. The Upanishadic prayer is 35. And there's four prayers. Four shlokas.
Four shlokas. For the 39
over space. And then you grab the five for 35. Or that.
Yeah, it's five, still five slokas, right?
And then it's actually 36 to 39. No.
The verse numbers?
Back there.
34, 35, yeah.
That's 35, and then down should be 36 to 39.
And then, 6 to 39.
And then four slokas.
Four slokas, okay.
That part of that.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really suffering from sleep deprivation for various reasons. I mean, they're going to, but yeah, okay. There we go. Now we got it right. At last. Okay, so now we go to Uttara Kuru Varsha, which is the end of the chapter. And then the next two ones will spill over into the next chapter. So see, the previous chapter has Ilavrita Varsha in it. And then, so it starts in the previous chapter, then this chapter, which is the residence of Jambudvipa for prayers, there's still two more to go, two varshas to go. There's two southern ones. We already did one southern one, which is Hari Varsha, as we went around, and now we come back down and do the full sweep of the islands. The varshas with the southern, the last two southern ones, yeah.
Who did the titling of the chapters?
I don't know where those chapter titles come from. I don't know.
When it was originally spoken and broken up,
I don't know when the chapter divisions, the canto divisions, or the chapter. You know, we know in the Bible that fairly late, you can find copies of Bibles where they didn't have the verses numbered, and it was done fairly late, just to facilitate reference. But when this took place, whether it was there beginning, whether Vyasa did it, I have no idea. When that happened, or who supplied the chapter titles. I wish I had my Sanskritist here, because he could tell me all these things.
Same thing with the Bhagavad Gita. When Krishna spoke, he spoke
it well,
didn't say, oh, now it's
down to
chapter 9.
he just spoke, it was like a quick job, and then somebody later chain put them into chapters. When it was probably when it was put into the Mahabharata. This is a great report. philosophers and scientists have been trying to study the entire cosmic situation, have been theorizing and calculating in different ways for millions and millions of years. You think this is a recent endeavor? It's been going on for a long time. However, you know, we just don't know the past. We just, you know, and when Kali Yuga began, basically what I understand from Bhagavatam is everyone is now brain damaged. Because what the Bhagavatam says is the power, matter loses its power, and foodstuff loses nourishing qualities. And because of that, we're all brain damaged compared to. And now, then you know, we sort of like try to, we don't know anything anymore. And something like Bhagavatam, which is the product of a far superior culture, we even think of some primitive mythology and don't see it. I've just been reading this, I've just finished reading this very interesting book called 1491. Those of us who grew up in the United States were taught a certain history that when the Europeans came, 1492 is the year that Columbus landed in America, that before the Europeans came to America, it was pretty much was an undeveloped wilderness with a few primitive Indian tribes wandering around. That's the story we were told. And 1491 is reporting on various archaeological and anthropological findings, and which are pretty much starting to become the mainstream. That at the time before Columbus came, in the Americas, it was more populated than Europe, and had bigger cities and bigger developments, and so on. And that what seems to have happened is when the Europeans came, there was a devastation. The first devastation being things like measles, smallpox, influenza, and other diseases people had no protection against. So that there may have been a total population loss within 100 or 200 years of maybe 85% to 90% of the people. You can see very early accounts of very early explorers coming into the Americas and reporting big cities, huge metropolises, people reporting going down the Amazon, for example, very early people going down the Amazon River and finding solid villages for hundreds of miles, where now it's an empty jungle. And everybody thought, oh, this is fantasies. People going down the coast of like northern New England seeing solid Indian villages all the way down the coast. Just want to tell you just how wrong everybody is. And so now people are beginning to discover, and actually there were these things all along which people didn't deal with because it just contradicted the major idea. People would like to believe America was there up for grabs, you know. But it was just an extremely, and a civilization that was very advanced in many ways. Of course, a lot of it's been destroyed. All the Mayan documents were almost all burnt by the Spanish. They had an extremely sophisticated calendar system, which begins about the same time, by the way, we say Kali Yuga started. I think there's a few years difference. And so on like that. You just don't know the past. And the Amazon jungle was large parts of it was an orchard. It was formed by human beings. And within the jungle you can find places where there's extremely, the rainforest has very poor soil. But you can find places where there's beds of extremely rich soil, and it was made by humans because it has a high charcoal content. And it's the kind of soil that just keeps on producing. Just like the Indians, you know, they developed this grain that we call corn now. That is this maize, Indian corn. Corn generally just meant the main grain of a country. And they developed a technique for growing it, where you have a stalk of corn and you have a bean plant going up around it. So the bean plant is nitrogen fixing, and then have they go corn, beans, and squash in the same patch. And by doing that, the land just never wore out. So like they just had some, and it looks like wildlife management and resource management was something they really, really knew how to do in a very incredible way. That's just a whole new, you know. 1491, it's out in paperback. You remember the author's name? I just gave it to you to read. He's a reporter that's been following what these anthropologists and archaeologists are coming up with. I'll bring it next time you can look at it. The year before Columbus came. And it's just really, really fascinating book. Since the paperback now has been out for a while, and he reports on all the controversies among the archaeologists about this kind of thing. See, some people really hate, the people that really hate this are the environmentalists, because it means like, you know, their pristine, untouched wilderness turns out to be not pristine and untouched at all, and it's not necessary that everything human beings put their hands on is a disaster. You just have to know how to do it, and so people did. And there have been people. Also, the idea was that, you know, humans arrived in this continent fairly recently, on the Americas fairly recently. But there's much evidence that you go way, way, way back. And you're getting closer to Prabhupada's world view and the Bhagavatam's world view about what was going on. Anyway, I just tell you that. And you know, because of the lack of survival of written records, or some things we just can't decipher. One of the Mesoamerican groups, I've forgotten which one now, instead of having writing, they pass messages on in the form of knotted cords. Which people knew how to do, but instead of by seeing, you'd do it by feeling, like Braille sort of, or both. So people have been studying for millions and millions and millions of years. Don't think we're the first to go through this, you know. However, the speculative research and work of so-called scientists or philosophers is always interrupted when he dies, and the laws of nature go on without regard for his work. So, of course, this is the vast scale of things. If you just take the simple description of what there is given by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, he said, I'm going to tell you everything there is to be known, and beyond this there's nothing further. And then he says, first he lists earth, water, fire, air, ether, manas, buddhi, ahankara, which Prabhupada expands to all the elements of the Sankhya. And then there's another energy. And these two come together, and from this the world arises, and both comes from me, and beyond me there's nothing further to be known. That's the whole picture. If you just take that brief account, what modern science does now is knows earth, water, fire, air, and ether. Manas, buddhi, and ahankara, they can't investigate. Yet those two are in part of the same causal network, because they're all material.
That means even when they investigate, they take one part, and right now they want to say that they're all there is, so they're always going to be wrong. Because they just have incomplete information. They deal with this because they can measure it and express it in terms of numbers. The decision is, science basically expresses the world in terms of numbers. Mechanistic science, Sadhguru calls it. And if it can be expressed in terms of numbers, they like to say it's not there, or it doesn't exist, or one day we'll turn it into numbers. So just in terms of numbers, that's the limitation. They miss out on so many other things. So there's a great appreciation here for the vastness of the Lord. He's called in this verse, you see this asankhyeya. The word asankhyeya, uncountable or innumerable or unclassified, names, forms, and everything. These wise imagine these numbers. But the truth, if you want to know, is the Lord. You have to obeisance to the Lord, who's the Sankhya Nidarshana, the revealer of the, at least as far as we can know it. You know, there's a passage in the 11th canto where Krishna tells, Uddhava says, you know, different thinkers, some say there's 24 elements, some say 16, there's something. Which one is right? And Krishna says basically they're all right, because since every element contains all the others, you can divide it up so many different ways.
And also with the six dashams mentioned, and Sri Krishna would say, and they're all right in their own way.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, even the material scientists are not exactly wrong, but they just take what is a partial view of the thing and try to make it into the whole. That's always the mistake, which is based on pride, really. I think you know more than you do. I know in America where there's this big textbook controversy going on, and Christian fundamentalists and literalists, you know, want to put something in the textbooks to indicate that evolution is a theory and not a fact. And they go. So anyway, one time I read a newspaper account that a group of them had taken a science textbook used in California and proposed a lot of changes. And the reporter who was reporting the article remarked that actually the changes weren't so bad and it just made people just a little more humble. That's all they did, you know, and it didn't seem so unreasonable, because there's so many things they don't know. But you know, it's funny, just to admit that this is a theory and we're working on it. And okay, let's go before the day comes to end to Uttareshu Kurushu, Kuru Varsha, which is at the total north, is called Uttara Kuru, where the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Kritavaraha Rupa, Aste, exists eternally. He says he's there, and his name in this form is Yajna Purusha. Form of the boar, which Prabhupada here, Yajna Purusha, who accepts all the results of sacrifices. Varaha Murti, if you read the descriptions of him earlier in the Bhagavatam, his body is made of sacrifices. The hairs in his body is the kusha grass. I didn't link it to this.
the evening I did 100.
100? Wow.
I catch it up.
So the Varaha Rupa is very much associated with Yajna. I don't know exactly why that is, but that's a fact there. So here he's called Yajna Purusha. And who's offering the prayers? Devi Asia Bhu. The goddess of earth, Bhu Devi. Mother Earth and all the inhabitants worship him with unfailing devotional service by repeatedly chanting the following Upanishad mantra. Here, this is where I got this Upanishad prayers from. The very last one in this chapter is Paramam Upanishadam, the Supreme Upanishad. Calls this Paramam Upanishadam, the process by which one can approach the Lord. Because the word Upanishad means to come near or approach nearby. People sometimes say it means, you know, so you approach the spiritual master to hear, the Upanishad, to sit nearby or approach nearby. So Prabhupada says the process by which one can approach the Lord. Avarchaya, I chant again and again for the purpose of practice. So here the Yajna Purush lives in the northern part of Jambudvip. There in the tract of land known as Uttarakuru Varsha, Mother Earth. And of course she's the one that has a relationship with him because she is Bhu Devi, who was rescued from the demon who abducted her and took her down to the lower regions.
Is this the first time where she became the white lower region?
Yes, because she has a child by him. Baumasura from Bhuma. Bhumi Omasura, that's right. Yeah. So here's one to chant. We have to split it up here. Maha Dvara. No, we can keep them together, I think. It's Maha Dwara, Great Sacrifices, Avyaya, I always have trouble when there's all these repetitions. Avayavaya, huh? Whose limbs and bodily parts are different kinds of sacrifices. The same thing, he's like the sacrifice personified. Dvara Vaya Vaya Mahapurushaya. Okay. Om Namo Bhagavate Mantra Tattva Lingaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Mantra Tattva Lingaya.
Yajna Krattave.
Yajna Krattave.
Mahadvara Vaya Vaya.
Mahadvara Vaya Vaya.
Mahapurushaya Namaha.
Mahapurushaya Namaha.
Karma Shuklaya Triyugaya Namaste.
Karma Shuklaya Triyugaya Namaste.
So Prabhupada translates this. We offer our respectful obeisances to you as the gigantic person. I think that's Mahapurush. He was a large form. Simply by chanting mantras, we shall be able to understand you fully. Mantra Tattva Lingaya, who is understood or whose form is the truth of mantras, who is understood in truth by different mantras, mantra tattva linga. You are yajna, sacrifice. You are the kratu, the ritual. Although in the word for word, Prabhupada says that he says animal sacrifices in kratave and animal, different kinds of animal sacrifices. Therefore, our ritualistic ceremonies of sacrifice are part of your transcendental body, and you are the enjoyer of all sacrifices. Your form is composed of transcendental goodness. This is Karma Shuklaya, which is also who purifies the fruit of activities of the living entities in the word for word. You are known as Triyuga, Triyugaya, because in Kali Yuga you appeared as a concealed incarnation. That's the gloss on Triyuga. And because you always fully possess the three pairs of opulences. That's another way of Triyuga. Yuga means a pair, so Triyuga, three pairs. So Prabhupada puts both those meanings in here. And so here in the purport to this, Prabhupada takes the opportunity to talk about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Lord is known as Triyuga because he, as he explained, he comes in Kali Yuga as a Chana Avatara, a covered avatar, because he doesn't appear as God but as a devotee. So therefore, Triyuga. So he's called Triyuga many times. Although also, when Krishna's horoscope was read by Garga Rishi, Garga Muni, he mentions four yugas and four colors. That's reconciled. Okay. And by manipulating a fire-generating stick, great saints and sages can bring forth a fire lying dormant within wood. Jatavedism. So they use this word Jataveda in here. That's also in one of the ring islands. They worship Agni according to the name Jataveda, which means it's fire that's produced in this way from wood. Jatavedism. In the same way, O Lord, those expert in understanding the absolute truth try to see you in everything, even in their own bodies. Yet you remain concealed. You notice this is a consistent theme here. You are not to be understood by indirect processes involving mental or physical activities because you are self-manifested. Only when you see that a person is wholeheartedly engaged in searching for you do you reveal yourself. Therefore, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. So the word that's used here, is gudam. You are hidden. But then they offered the vaisances irrita atmane unto the Lord who is manifest. And the Prabhupada has a long point here. Yeah, the word Jataveda means fire which is produced by rubbing wood. It's also the fire in the stomach. Prabhupada just comments on these various different things. Quoting the Upanishads here. Let's go through here. The Drovya Kriya, the objects of material enjoyment. Drovya Kriya. Drovya, the objects of material enjoyment. Kriya, the activities of the senses. Hetu, the predominating deities of sensory activities. You see in the second canto, these three things are delineated. Drovya, Shakti, Kriya, Shakti, Jnana, Shakti, the powers of that produce the material objects, the powers that produce the senses, and the Jnana Shakti is the operating system of the devatas. Since those of you who are taking should know this, the BIHE, the Bhakti Vaibhava course.
Second canto.
Huh? Second canto. So I taught it last year. The objects of material enjoyment, the activities of the senses, the control of the senses activities. So that's like one classification of the universe. And also they evolve out of goodness, passion, and ignorance. The systems like that. The body, eternal time, and egotism are all creations of your material energy. Those whose intelligence has become fixed by perfect execution of mystic yoga can see all these elements result from the action of your external energy. They can also see your transcendental form as super soul in the background of everything. Therefore, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. Prabhupada just talks about those various things. The presence of Krishna in the background.
He's quoted that 9-10, Mayadakshina, three times in the last 10 couples.
Yeah, that's right.
The rest of 10. Three times.
But that's more or less, you know, an emphasis in these things about this, that the Lord is the controller. Remember, these prayers are all worship, are offered by very prominent personalities. So they all have positions of controllers. So those people, those are the kind of people who want to really emphasize that they're not in control with the Lord, that they're devotees. It's the same thing that we should notice is when we, for example, I became a servant of Srila Prabhupada. I'll just tell the story because this is how I started to think about it. I was one day out distributing magazines in the streets of Philadelphia, and I used to go to the same place, same time every day, and distribute back to God in magazines. And there was always this guy watching me. Day after day, he'd be sort of hanging out and watching me, older man. And finally, he came up to me, and he said to me, "You know, I'm impressed by you people. You work so hard. You're so dedicated. You're so, I like that. You're dedicated. You're serious. You work so hard. You're really." All of you are really impressive, he says. But the problem is you sit out here and you distribute these magazines and you collect all this money, but then you give it all to him. And you point Prabhupada's picture in the front of the back. It all goes to him. and he's just in, taking it all and enjoying and living high in the hog with, you know, with mansions and cars and everything like that. And so I really feel bad because you're working so hard and you're just being exploited. So I tried to explain to him that Prabhupada was not like that, that he wasn't sitting at the top enjoying. And he just didn't buy it. So I started thinking about this for some time, and then I realized he had a point, that when you see people working and sacrificing their energy for somebody, somebody at the top is enjoying. But Prabhupada wasn't at the top. See, Krishna's at the top. And basically, Prabhupada I'm serving him. If he were the enjoyer, then I'd be being exploited by somebody who was not in a position. But Prabhupada, I'm his servant, but he's a bigger servant than I am. So because he was a bigger servant than I am, I didn't mind becoming his servant. So that's how the system of authority works. If there's an actual system, a hierarchical system of authority, it will all work so long as everybody, whatever their level, is a servant. Until you come to the one person who is the master, and that's Krishna. As soon as the servants in their various levels try to become the masters and keep something for themselves, that's when it breaks down. And see, our whole experience of hierarchy is this. Exploitation and envy and people trying to become the master. So that's why it's important for all these people who are lords of the various dvipas and prominent citizens and everything, that they emphasize that Krishna is the master. And so we can again have a hierarchical system that Prabhupada wants. I mean, if Varnashram Dharma is nothing if not hierarchical. And boy, today is that ever a bad word, hierarchical. Well, according to feminists, it's a male plot, an invention of males, and that is the most evil thing in the world, and we have to get rid of hierarchy everywhere. I mean, when Prabhupada was in Detroit, you can hear the tape. They brought some priests to talk to him, and Prabhupada was trying to explain to them how our movement is trying to make Brahmins. So he had to explain what a Brahmin is. So he used this terminology: first class man, second class man, third class man, and fourth class man. And although I was hearing the tape, I knew what was going on. But he probably gave this brilliant thing about how these four classes have been and what a brahmana is, and that's what we don't have in our country, is first class men. So our movement is trying to make first class men. The Prabhupada finishes with a very substantial idea of talking what a brahmana is and the modes of nature. Prabhupada finished talking, and then somebody said, "So what do you think?" And there was a silence, and then one of the priests says, "Well, we would say that is elitist." Just because he used this language, first class, second class, third class, he couldn't get beyond it. And here, as priests, they should express, they should appreciate what a brahmana is and why we need them. So the hierarchy is on the outs, although it keeps reasserting itself all the time. Because there's always going to be weak and stronger, and those with greater powers of action and those with lesser powers of action. That division will always be there. And, the Vedas just acknowledge it and let's use it properly. But it will work. This was called this was referred to as the great chain of being. That the whole universe is, it's just in Europe, the whole universe, it goes back to Greek and Rome, the whole universe is hierarchical. That at the top is God. And then below, in Europe there were angels in ranks, cherubim, seraphim, thrones, dominion, powers, they went down in a hierarchy of angels. The word hierarchy literally means holy order. Hieros means holy, like hieroglyphics, holy sacred writing, sacred or holy. Arche means order. It means sacred order. That's the meaning of the term. Etymological meaning, huh? Arche is Greek.
Greek.
Hieros.
Hieros.
Is holy. And the other is arche. Anarche, no ruler. So this is a holy order. Then you get to humans, and then who's at the top of the humans? Well, the king, of course. And then there's counts, barons, you know, various ranks of nobility, and then that goes all the way down. Then you get to the animals. Who's the king of the beasts? We all know. The lion, right? And then, among the minerals, who's king? Well, gold, you know. So the whole universe was seen as a hierarchy, you know, going starting from God and down to the bare squiddle of nothing. That was a universal vision in Europe and everywhere. And then the 18th and 19th century, it started to crash. It started to fall apart. I told you there's a book, The Great Chain of Being, which talks about that. And the crash was, you know, people started, really, God starts to get lost. But we get rid of kings in Europe. We get rid of priests in Europe. You know the French Revolution? One of the French, the thinkers of the French Revolution, Diderot, said, mankind will never be free until the last king is strangled with the intestines of the last priest. This is Enlightenment thinking. Our whole modern world is based on this kind of ideas.
Can you call it once again, please?
Mankind, or human, yeah, man will never be free until the last king is strangled by the intestines of the last priest.
Who said it?
Diderot. I cannot spell French, but Diderot. There's a whole group of French intellectuals put together the thing with this encyclopedia. He was one of them. Yeah. So we have seen this crash. It goes down. And so we want, you know, this is the century of the common man and everybody's equal and so on and so forth. And anytime there's power, and we see, anytime there's power, we think it's evil. Because whenever there's power, there's exploitation, and power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and all these other kind of things. And so people just want to get rid of it. But it always comes up, it's always there. But if you understand that especially in our system, if there's real brahmanas, and the brahmanas are really in control in their own way of the kshatriyas, then you see the biggest leaders are the biggest servants, the devotees, and not only are they, but perceive like that, then everything will work. As soon as someone tries to take the position of God, it becomes tough. Anyway, we'll have to finish this off tomorrow, and maybe tomorrow we'll finish Jambudvipa. No, we won't go through, because there's a whole lot of stuff about Bhart Varsha. We'll finish the prayers, and then there's a little folk on the special nature of Bhart Varsha. And Narada Muni sings prayers to Narayan, and the demigods sing prayers to the glories of Bhart Varsha. That's what's depicted in chapter 19. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. I don't know what changing I'm saying.